No, a kind of pastime of a leisure class, you must have heard this kind of thing. And on the other hand, and the biblical faith, of course, that is superstition. I mean, people use more dignified expression sometimes, but that's what they meant. Yeah? Now, the moment this, I would say the immediate cause of the despair, I think, is the breakdown of these hopes, which are about 4 centuries old. And but you seem to speak of a deeper despair, which even a man could have had, say, without being disappointed by the modern development, that he tries philosophy on the one hand and he tries revelation on the other, and both dissatisfy. Yeah, but is there a third possibility to turn, except those which a thinking being would, from both points of view, see to be inadequate? You know, the pursuit of wealth, power, and this kind of thing. You can call that despair. I think in a deeper sense it is despair to do that.
Doesn't the absence of the thoroughness alternative only, does it not only intensify the
dream? Yeah, but it makes it still more necessary, doesn't it? I mean, I would put it this way, if I stated the difficulty correctly in my concluding remarks, that would make philosophy itself a problem. And the question is there an alternative then except revelation? I know that there are enormous difficulties there too, but in principle, because revelation admits in principle that the basis of faith is theoretically uncertain. And the faith not only can afford it, but gladly admits that, because otherwise it wouldn't be faith, whereas for philosophy it is impossible. In other words, is this difficulty, I raise this as a question, is this difficulty in which philosophy finds itself not a kind of indirect proof of the theological assertion that without faith, and by faith means faith in God, a man cannot live consistently? The man who has faith does not contradict himself by having faith. But the man who seeks evident knowledge, and regards this as the highest activity of man, and is unable to give an evident account of that, would he not contradict himself? In other words, the despair as far as it would lie on the power of philosophy. But maybe the situation of philosophy is not sufficiently described by that.
Well, why should the man beyond open sphere like Socrates have to admit the possibility of revelation?
You can't hear that question.
Well, why does a man who doesn't see the necessity for hope and fear and doesn't have these things, why must he admit the possibility of revelation? Any more than he must admit the possibility of the man green shape.
Well, weren't you present yesterday when we discussed in another place the statements which Aristotle makes about the philosophic life? You know, are there not certain difficulties there? I don't know which was the point which was made by that on that particular occasion, but are there not really difficulties? Now, but still we would have to ask ourselves, why do you want to be a philosopher? Yeah? Surely he gives some reason. Are these reasons sufficient? That's the question. If they are, my argument in the last section would break down. But if they are not, if Socrates philosophizes in such a manner that his choice of philosophy is fundamentally as unaccountable as any other non-rational choice, what would happen? That is the question. Now, in other words, the point is this. The central point of my last argument was the possibility of revelation. Socrates has never said that he admits the possibility of revelation. We find the argument is an approximation to the argument you would find in the first five pages of the Laws, where he discusses in some brief allusions the divine origin of the Cretan or Spartan code. Now, that is, of course, is very simple, you know, suppose of that in two sentences. That's not as easy with the Bible. So we have certainly not an explicit, for obvious historical reasons we don't have it, but I would say it is, we certainly do not have an explicit discussion of the possibility of revelation. The implication of Socrates certainly is, it is impossible. It's impossible, but what is the value of these arguments? What about the Socrates' natural theology? He cannot have meant that, cannot possibly have meant that he has adequate knowledge of the essence of God. I mean, that would contradict the whole tenor of his thinking. How is that? It's a question. But if it is true, if Socrates would have to admit the possibility of revelation, his whole life, the choice of his whole life would remain a question. By the way, there are some indications, if you look at it, that he regarded this as altogether, not altogether impossible, if you think of a passage where he speaks of a noble danger which he is taking, a noble risk in the Phaedo, in a somewhat different context. Yes?
Did you characterize the first part of your lecture, the philosophic way of life, as a passion or eros for the truth?
Yeah.
Is this passion related either essentially or accidentally to those passions which, according to philosophers, impede their search for the truth?
Well, related, yes. But not dependent on them. Well, as you have read, I suppose, the Phaedrus, where he describes, where Plato describes the three stages. Here there is this most simple form of eros, which is desire for procreation, and the higher form, which is desire for fame, for immortal fame, and then the third is philosophic eros. So there is a kinship there, but also a difference. And certainly, what Plato implies is that the two others, to a certain extent, impede the highest, to a certain extent. And naturally, the ordinary passions, obviously, I mean, you know that from your own experience, if you are emotionally disturbed, you have difficulties in concentrating on something. But the term passion is indeed questionable. If you mean that, I can't do that. Because by passion we normally mean a kind of disturbance, don't we? But what Plato means by the eros, one can simply describe as follows, to get rid of another paradox of which you may have thought. It is attachment. Yeah. Every eros is an attachment to that which you love. An attachment, but the philosophic eros is attachment, one can say attachment to detachment. That is its paradox. But otherwise, if it is mere, without that passion, as what I call passion, or what you can call perhaps better attachment, there could not be a real concern. But this concern, that is the only concern in which the concerned being is in a way completely forgotten. And that is Plato's meaning and understanding of that. And therefore it can be culminate in detachment. Please.
I wonder whether there is not an alternative to philosophy as you have regarded as well as to revelation. And if I amplify that question.
Please.
It seems to me that philosophy, as you have been discussing it, implies an emphasis on man's power to reason, reasoning, a rationalistic point of view, and perhaps neglects the other aspects of human beings, talking about how human beings should live, in considering itself, that is, philosophy, considering itself as a way of life. On the other hand, it seems to me that religions which emphasize revelation have also failed to take into account certain important aspects of human beings as human beings, then is there not perhaps a third alternative to those that you have discussed? Let me bring out another question that might clarify that. Is it not possible that what you spoke of as the small achievements of social science are in actuality the small achievements of
I said they are not so great.
Is it possible that what you described as the not so great achievements of social science are more fundamentally to be considered the not so great achievements of pre-scientific philosophy and of religion, both of which have had much longer had a much longer span of life, both of which we've been playing with for a much longer time than we've been playing with the concepts of social science?
Yeah, that are two entirely different questions. Although I assume that there is some hidden connection in you between them. Now, as for the first question, I do not know whether you refer to mysticism as the third alternative. I do not know that.
No.
But can you give me an example? The question of mysticism is really a very difficult one, to which I did not even allude. Perhaps one word. And that mysticism, I think, is really something in between philosophy and revelation in its primary claim.
My thoughts were as far from mysticism.
Yeah, but honestly, then I didn't understand you at all.
I shall try to illustrate what it means. It seems to me that both the rationalistic tradition, which it seems to me you've been emphasizing as philosophy, and religion have neglected certain of the emotional or misinterpreted certain of the emotional components of human beings. For example, it seems to me that there's been a misunderstanding on the part of both of the legitimate function of hostility and hostility expression.
There were plenty of philosophers who admitted that.
Pardon me?
There were plenty of philosophers who admitted that. The possibility of war. Yeah, the essential possibility of war was very generally admitted in the past.
Well, I don't admit that.
But which hostility do you want? Between individuals? Well, I think by admitting meaning hostility among groups, they must have their roots in the individual somehow.
Yes, I see.
Is war not enough for what?
Pardon?
I mean, does war not fulfill your requirements for hostility?
Unfortunately, I think it overfulfills.
No, do you mean then competition, for example, which is a kind of hostility, I take it?
I have in mind a struggle for equality of relationships, which is something that is not achieved in general by wars, it seems to me.
Yeah, but what has this to do with hostility? It has, you mean hostility to inequality, which would be a subdivide, if I understand you correctly, hostility to injustice, yeah? That I hope we all are. I mean, I really don't find it. But to make this quite clear, since you bring in this word rationalism, I would say this. I started from one premise. I don't know why I didn't state it. That perhaps because it is so evident, so obvious to me. Man cannot live without some light. Some guidance. And the emotions as emotions are not enough. The emotions don't give, they need some control, at least some channeling. And this light can either be human light, the light of man, in man, or the divine light. I see no alternative. Because I believe the light, if you call that light, which the brutes have, would be absolutely insufficient for us. I mean, we would have to really to commit a kind of suicide to live as Buddhas.
Is it not possible that you're suggesting the desirability of a static goal rather than the desirability of having as our fundamental goal the very process of growth, of meeting challenges?
Yeah, but what does growth mean? I mean, for example, a tree grows.
Me searching for meaning and meeting the challenges of life.
Yeah, but still, when you speak of growth, I take it you mean a movement in a certain direction. Yeah, I mean, a tree which would grow into the earth would not be called to grow properly. So, in other words, you would have some, if you are concerned with your growth, you must have some notion of the direction in which the growth takes place. Without that direction, you could not speak of growth or its opposite. You must have some criterion for distinguishing between growth and a retrograde movement. Now, this notion, this thing of which you are aware, is prior, theoretically, to every other judgment of this kind. That either you know what, how do you know that? Either you have found out by your own thinking, including observation, reflection, etc., or you know it by divine revelation. I see no third way, honestly.
We may know it as the tree knows it. I hope I'm not taking the question.
Yeah, but you see, but for the tree, the whole problem, we are not trees at the time. the whole problem, no, we would have no problem whatever if we were trees. That's really...
I may be out of here with this record. I may be going on the old ground, but I was wondering, there are occasions where Plato advises certain young politicians to get in a tight spot, if they got to kill or commit an injustice, to go off and pray. To go away and pray. Not to do this, but to pray.
I don't remember at the moment the passage, but I'm sure you have read it. But let us assume he said it. I mean, that's really been invented. Yeah, and what? He could have said that.
Well, he was his advice to Dion's friends, who were, and he said that before you kill anybody, commit an injustice, better go off and pray.
Yeah. He didn't say
anything about philosophizing.
Yeah, were they philosophers? And in a qualified sense, Plato could admit that insofar as praying certainly implies a kind of collecting oneself, yeah, and reminding oneself of man's limitations. I do not believe that Plato would have meant the same thing what a biblical author would have meant by that. Incidentally, I said at the beginning, making allowance for these cases, even more clear in some Stoic texts, where it would seem that biblical faith and philosophy fade into the same. I mentioned in this connection that even prayer can be admitted under certain conditions by philosophers, and still there would be a fundamental difference, would nevertheless remain. Yeah.
Well, wouldn't that indicate that Plato saw at least at the political level, perhaps, that there was some common ground between
Oh, yeah, I am sure in that sense, certainly. I spoke of that, I think, last time. Now, that is clear, that from the philosophic point of view, revelation can be recognized as very salutary in good, but in a subordinate function, just as vice versa, the theologian and most theologians would say that philosophy is very salutary in good, but in a subordinate function. There's no difficulty in that, but the point is that each of the two, the revelation and philosophy, claim to be not a handmaid, but the queen. And therefore, that is no solution to the fundamental conflict. It blunts the edges, but it doesn't remove the fundamental conflict.
Mr.
Strauss,
can you say some more about how Dostoevsky conceived of the alternatives? You said that he dismissed.
Well, no, I meant only the famous discussion of panslavism and the possessed. You know, panslavism being a use of Russian Christianity for the purpose of Russian nationalism. You have the same thing in France. You had the same thing in France in the Charles Maurras, these people, you know, who was called a Catholic atheist. He was a Catholic only insofar as Catholicism was part of the French heritage. Yeah? He was not primarily Catholic and then thereafter also accidentally a Frenchman. He was primarily and in a sense nothing but a Frenchman. But seeing that to be a 100% Frenchman meant to accept the French past, the cathedrals and whatnot, so he accepted also Catholicism. And that Dostoevsky discusses this, and you have the same thing, of course, I've seen also sometimes in Zionism. The Jews, Zionists accepted the Jewish religious inheritance, not in its original meaning, but as a part of the national law. Yeah? As a part of the national law. And that, I think, is really impossible. And what Dostoevsky showed, I think, so convincingly and strongly in the possessions, precisely, I forgot, what was the name? Kirillov? I forget the Russian name. Kirillov? That is his conflict, that he becomes aware of that absurdity, to subordinate God to Russia. Now, to subordinate God to Western civilization is, of course, the same absurdity. To say we must preserve Western civilization and therefore we need a faith which keeps the West together and therefore let us establish the traditional faith, and that means only you want to have a myth, a solitary social myth. If people do not believe in God because they believe in God, and that may accidentally have a favorable or unfavorable effect on the future of Western civilization, that is the wrong way to go about it, seems to me. Yeah, well, but then one has to admit, to be honest to oneself, that one embarks on a platonic venture of a noble lie. I mean, those who have the nerves to do that may do it, but then at least they must be honest to themselves. I mean, certainly it is intolerable in a theologian, I think, that you would admit. Mr. King.
If, as you say, vitality of Western civilization depends on this continuing fundamental antagonism of both theology and philosophy, still the primary stake of each would seem to be in itself.
And, sure.
And therefore each must then in turn consider the value to it simply of Western civilization. So that one then is supposed to ask, what is the relative value of the perpetuation of the conflict and of Western civilization to each respectively? It would seem to be somewhat different.
Oh, in the first place, I would say, and that I accept this as a criticism of my whole series, my criticism which my vanity forces me to say I anticipated. that both for the believer and for the philosopher, Western civilization cannot be a primary concern. Yeah? I mean, the philosopher being concerned with the truth, with the theoretical truth, and the believer concerned with the love of God, cannot be primarily concerned with Western civilization, only accidentally. And it was a kind of adaptation to the general approach of today, yeah, that I started from the problem of Western civilization. Ultimately, that must be transcended from every point of view. Or, as one can also state it, people talk much today about culture, you know, and want to have, again, a genuine culture compared with that somewhat decaying culture with which we are confronted. Now, I would say this, the best way of never getting a culture is to worry about culture. What is usually meant by culture is a byproduct of much more serious concern.
Well, if one substitute for culture or civilization that kind of political order or, say, political climate, which was common with philosophy.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I wonder if the people asking the questions could speak just a little louder, since we have such a large crowd here.
I mean, one could still then ask if the concern with the political order was not more germane to one, that is, to its own vitality than to the other. That is, it's, it would be quite conceivable that it might be absolutely crucial to the vitality of one and inessential to the other.
You speak very cryptically, and I'm not quite sure whether I understood you. But I understood you to mean that the concern with the political order must be greater for the philosopher as philosopher than for the believer as believer, insofar as the philosopher has no guarantee for the continuation of the philosophic tradition, except human efforts properly directed, whereas the believer has a guarantee for the continuation of what is most important in divine promise. Is this what you meant?
Yes.
Yeah.
Both being concerned with their own vitality primarily, yet each would have perhaps either a lack of concern or an entirely opposite concern with the perpetuity of a certain...
But I would have not the slightest difficulty in seeing that both, to the extent to which the believer or the philosopher are quite serious, they are concerned not with the perpetuation of a conflict and its vitality, and the ensuing vitality, but with their concern. But secondarily, they may be concerned, and believe they are necessarily concerned, with the survival of the other. For example, I think the believers have, an interest in the continuation of the tradition of rational thought in a subordinate function.
But is not the consideration of alternatives to faith a much inferior concern to the believer than is the consideration of possible alternatives to the philosophy?
Yes, but yeah, but from a religious point of view, to leave everything to God's providence and not to do one's manifest duty, yeah, that duty which God imposed upon man, which implies a certain care for one's time and even for foreseeable posterity. I mean, do not religious people perfectly legitimately build the synagogues, the Hillel Foundation, or churches, and other institutions meant for future generations in perfect agreement with the principles of faith? I mean, it is not as simple as that. From a religious point of view, after all, man is given specific duties, yeah? Specific duties which he has to fulfill, and the difference, I think, is only this. The difference concerns the certainty regarding the promise. There is no promise from the philosophic point of view which guarantees the continuation of philosophy. Yeah?
Would the duty of what you call the being of love, would this include the consideration of philosophy as a possible alternative?
I think in a wider sense, yes. Well, look, I stated to you from the Old Testament, since you are a Christian, I don't want to speak about things which you know much better, or at least are supposed to know much better than I do. When in the Bible, the Torah is called, in the Torah itself, the Torah is called, "This is your wisdom in the eyes of the nations." Yeah? That implies that the nations, meaning the non-believing peoples, are capable to recognize the wisdom of the Torah to a certain extent. And it is important from the point of view of Judaism, for example, that this wisdom be understood by others as far as it can be understood without the Jewish faith. And similar things, think of the very practical necessity of apologetics, which some people despise, but which is an absolute necessity for everyone. In every religious community, on all levels, from children on, an inevitable practical necessity. And no apologetics is possible without using philosophy,
yeah,
consciously or unconsciously, as handmade, of course, but necessary. To say nothing of other things where it's quite obvious, the calendar. Yeah? It's an important part of every religious tradition, the religious calendar. You need astronomy, mathematics, to say nothing of medicine, which could partly fall under the heading of love of one's neighbor, to help him, yeah? Help the sick. And so there is no, I think it's, one mustn't state the problem merely in these very abstract terms. And I think what is true only, and as far as the most general things are concerned, is, as I said before, there is no, is that human effort is doubtless, much more depends on human effort from the point of view of philosophy than from the point of view of faith. Than I would say. Because the future is not guaranteed.
This necessary dependence on philosophy of the handmaiden would necessarily include its consideration as being possibly more than a handmaiden?
Perhaps on the part of very wise theologian, and sometimes they are very wise theologians, say that we cannot have that great subordinate good, yeah, except by admitting that some of them will regard it as the highest good. Just as you cannot have, I suppose, very great generals without having from time to time a general who loves war as war. I think this example is not altogether inappropriate. You know that. A general as general does not have to love war as war, obviously. He does not have to think, as a famous German general thought, that an eternal peace is a dream and not even a beautiful one. He does not have to think that, but still the temptation to have this attitude is greater for a man of war than for people of peaceful lives like ourselves. But I could imagine a wise statesman saying, well, in order to have always a supply of very good generals, I'm perfectly willing to allow of the possibility that sometimes a real bellicist, or maybe more than one, appears among. And so a wise theologian, I think, would admit that since philosophy or science and medicine and what have you are good things in their proper place, that sometimes people of a kind of professional pride, you see, who over-exaggerate the importance of their pursuit, may rise. And I think similar views could be taken by a wise philosopher of the need for theologians. And as a matter of fact, I think both thoughts have been developed. As for the philosophers, I remember there is a treatise by Averroes, you know, a very famous medieval philosopher, a Muslim philosopher, who assigns the theologians a certain place in his whole scheme. Even Nietzsche did that, as you know.
Could you say something more? You talked about the ultimate insufficiency of morality in Greek philosophy, and you said that contemplation is sort of analogous to the love of God. How far does that take?
Yes, that I said. Or you can also say piety if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little more about that? How far does that analogy hold?
From this point of view, that the moral life is moral life. It takes the most well-known part of moral life, our behavior toward other human beings, our right behavior toward other human beings, that even if it is perfectly right, yeah, it would not be enough. That is said by both revelation and philosophy. Yeah? Revelation saying, you know, you must love God with all your might and so on, and whereas you should love your neighbor only as yourself. Yeah? And the philosophers say something entirely different, but parallel to that. That if a man would be just in all his dealings with his fellow men, he would still be a kind of mutilated being if he were not more than that. And for example, to show one point, you cannot act justly without having some knowledge of the principles of justice. Now, you can have these principles either because your parents and teachers told them to you, or you can know them because you have understood them by your own effort. Now, from the point of view of the philosopher, certainly, the man who understands them by his own effort is higher. Something in him is activated, which has not been activated in the case of the other. Yeah? And let us furthermore assume that a man who, it is impossible to know the true principles of justice without knowing much more, then you arrive at that. That is one consideration. They have other considerations of this kind, that all life of justice or morality is an active life, a life of busyness. And there is a certain imperfection in busyness itself. And therefore, the highest activity of man must have be an activity of leisure, as distinguished from busyness. And so many and other considerations. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Schultz, you spoke about the and the succession of mythology by philosophy and the implied criticism of mythology and philosophy. Yeah. I wonder if you would amplify a little bit on the statements you made. You were quite clear.
Yeah, surely not. Well, I don't think that I can do much more than repeat what I said. When Aristotle speaks of the first philosophers, yeah, in the first book of Metaphysics, he calls them physiologoi, the men who have make discourses on physics, on nature. And he mentions that they're preceded by other men who also made discourses. And he calls them theologoi, men who make the discourses on gods. Yeah? So if we take this as indicative, as it doubtless is, for the state of affairs, the characteristic element of philosophy is physis, the discourse of physis. And the myths, I mean, in this sense, would then be the accounts of the stories about gods. Now, these stories about gods or God, as stories, as distinguished from findings based on observation. You don't forget the demonstrations of the existence of God were terribly important for the whole philosophic tradition, not only for Aristotle, but for Plato as well. So the myth would then be such those accounts of God or gods as are not based on reasoning, or not essentially based on reasoning. From the Greek point of view, of course, the Bible would be a mythical document. That goes without saying. But we legitimately enlarge or specify the meaning of myth for the following reason. There is a radical difference between the Bible and certainly the Greek myth. Yeah? But one can say between the Bible and any other myth, any myth proper, because only in the Bible do we find the notion of divine omnipotence. I mean, the statement that the gods can everything, are omnipotent, occurs everywhere in classical antiquity, as you know, but it isn't understood. In the Bible, the meaning is understood. Or to take an other example, what was always taken as of great importance, the emphasis on morality in the Bible. That was, for example, in the analysis which Hermann Cohen made of these things, that was a decisive reason why he said that the Bible is fundamentally transmythical. Now, if we take then this as a starting point, as a very provisional starting point, then one would arrive at this statement which I suggested, that myth as myth is characterized by the fact that there are gods, and on the other hand, limitations of the gods. Very clear in the Greek notion of the moira. Yeah? Now, philosophy, Greek philosophy, certainly in its original meaning, original intention, transforms this mythical notion of the limitations of God into the notion of nature and ananke, ultimately intelligible necessity. And whether or not there are God or gods within that necessity or beneath it, that is an open question. I mean, there are such...
I would have assumed that the nature was more, this was more of a substitute for Moira than for the God.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I say here the Moira, as Moira, is transformed into physis or ananke, yes, surely. And whether there are God, is a God or gods within this context of intelligible necessity, or the, however you might call it, that's a dispute about that. And ultimately depends on the question of the soul. But the Bible takes the diametrically opposite solution, namely, and the omnipotent God, and therefore no Moira, is the highest being, highest principle. So this is diametrically opposed to the Greek solution. But both solutions burst asunder the mythical context. There is at least one way of looking at it.
Well, I wonder, I mean, I wonder if in Homer, the description of the gods working within Moira doesn't, in a sense, become equivalent, I mean, to philosophy.
All right, then it would mean Greek philosophy begins already in Homer. Then.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
That's a historical, very important, but really historical question. But it would not be concerned the fundamental point of...
Of course not.
And that alone we are concerned. But the difficulty is this. Because myth was originally defined, as you know, by the Greek philosophers. I mean, the distinction between mythos and logos, and I don't speak now of the complications that in another way Plato, as you know, admits myth as an essential part of philosophy. That does not mean myth in the primary sense of the term. Now, if we enlarge the meaning, and so that we try to define myth in such a manner as to distinguish it in the same act from both Greek philosophy and from the Bible, then we assume in a way a common ground between the Bible and Greek philosophy, and that is the root of the difficulty. We have to do that, otherwise we could not make any comparison, as I've tried to make it. But on the other hand, if my view is correct, that there is this radical discrepancy, this radical antagonism, that very basis of my analysis is doubtful, because clearly my analysis was that of a historian or social scientist and not of a theologian. Yeah? I mean, a theologian would have to... There is no neutral account of this difference, you see, and that reflects itself in the difficulty regarding myth.
Couldn't you say that from it, Plato's point of view, making a distinction between mythos and logos.
Yeah.
The Bible itself
is
considered a kind of myth. That is...
Sure, Plato would have no choice. Plato would say nomos and mythos combined, sure. But that would be true. Mythos combined, just as Hammurabi, I mean. It's clear. There is no alternative. And by the way, the terms were used by the first Greeks who became acquainted with Judaism. They used these terms. Naturally. And that is simple. The difficulty would be what is a Platonic myth, because that is obviously something different from what you usually understand by myth. Mr. Yes.
If you took the laughter of Abraham and the philosopher and equated them, could you do that, first of all? I mean, You could consider the laughter of Abraham as a philosophical.
I do not think. I believe that laughing of the Bible is radically different from philosophic serenity.
From what?
Philosophic serenity.
No, I don't mean in this sense. I mean when God tells Abraham that...
Salah.
Yeah, but Sarah.
Yeah, man. That does make some difference.
Pardon?
No. I mean, that is... You see, no, I would say this. The biblical laughing is always related to crying, even if it comes last. Yeah? Always so. Inseparable from that.
Can I elaborate on that for a minute?
No, well, you know, that is, by the way, not only characteristic of the Bible. I think that is characteristic of human life as a whole. And think of the Homeric phrase, yeah? Dacro Joen Gelasasa, what Andromache did when Hector left and what was the name of the boy? Astyanax? This little baby got frightened, you know, by the... about a wholly irrelevant thing, namely about the helm of the father, whereas the thing to cry about would, of course, be that he goes to battle and he may never come back. And then she can't help smiling at his crying. That, I think, is a simple human attitude. You know, I mean, all our cryings and all our laughings are, I believe, related to each other, even if in given situations the one wins out over the other.
In this situation,
we will cry because we can laugh, and we laugh because we can cry. Now, so what the philosophers mean about that is that in the case of the philosopher, there is no place for both, strictly speaking, yeah, as philosopher, but a slight bias in favor of laughter.
Isn't the thing this laughter
is based on, Socrates, sir, take her out of context philosophically,
could be a philosopher laughing at the unnaturalness of
a... That's a surprise, but you... Is she not gratified? You know, no, that is, I think...
Isn't
she wishes it? Yeah. Yeah, well, I can only say that you would be hard put to it to express this.
Isn't Sarah only entitled to a kind of surreptitious knowledge of what's natural?
Yeah, no, perhaps it is a higher knowledge, insofar as what you would call natural would be, from a biblical point of view, if we try to retranslate a later term, I believe it is later in this one, she knows that is a custom, the normal, the custom, the customary, but God can act outside of the custom, and all the custom is God's action, ultimately, and therefore, and God can act outside of his customary way of behavior.
The problem for the philosopher, as you put it, the alternative is what it begins would be for the philosopher to laugh until the issue was shown.
Isaac. No. As philosopher, I think, no. I really don't see that. No, if he were the if it is a possibility, how can he laugh? But it would be stupid. It would be like a little child to whom you tell something of which he thinks that it's impossible, and so laughs about it.
But I'm wondering if this is the presupposition of philosophy.
It takes us up next time.
I was going to say that it is getting quite late.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And
I'm sorry.
Yes, there's one more question.
Yeah, I think it's only there.
I don't want to ask, but does it appear to you, as it does to Spengler, that the Roman Church is the ultimate in the institutionalization of the concept of revelation? And would you, as he does, exclude the Roman Church from the concept of the Western society, which, as your lectures are illustrating, is a society whose dynamism arises from this tension between two sources, biblical and
Good. On the contrary, I would say, on the